An outfit called Nexium has been in the headlines in the United States, and a couple of documentaries have examined how a company purporting to be a self-improvement organization became a manipulative criminal cult. It was headed by Keith Raniere. It drew Hollywood celebrities and rich listers, and now several of them are in jail for sex trafficking, fraud, racketeering and other offences. Apart from being sleazy, the details of how Keith Raniere ran Nexium sound quite mad, really. So how is it that ostensibly intelligent people can give themselves over to such an organisation? Dr. Janja Lalić is a sociology professor who spent decades helping people escape and recover from such manipulative groups. She's the author of several books and the founder and director of the Center for Research on Influence and Control. One of the books is called Bounded Choice. I asked her about Nexium, and I asked her how she would describe it.
Well, it purported to be a self-help cult where you, I mean, it didn't call itself a cult, obviously, purported to be a self-help company that could improve your skills and advance your career. And it primarily recruited in the field of acting through friendship networks, as most cults do, recruit through friendship networks. So I would say that Nexium, which offered these very, very expensive courses, was in a way kind of the front group to recruit people and bring them further in. And some of them would be encouraged to move to Albany, where Keith Raniere lived and where the, you know, headquarters was. So as you got closer to Albany, or as you went up in the ranks, the environment became more and more cult-like. And then within that, they formed another sort of secret cult within the cult.
And this secret cult was DOS, which seemed to be a subgroup of women.
Yes.
And what was that?
Well, that was essentially a way for Keith Raniere to further control and manipulate and have sexual relations with any woman he wanted. So the group was purported to be just for women, and it was secret. They weren't supposed to tell other people they were in it. And they set up a hierarchical, essentially slave structure where they were required to do whatever their master told them. And most of the women, most of the time, had no idea that Keith Raniere was actually behind all of this.
One of your books is called Bounded Choice. What is the bounded choice theory?
Well, basically, bounded choice explains, I think, for people, especially for people on the outside who wonder how people can do the things they do when they're in cults. Bounded choice describes the environment that closes in on you when you're in a cult. Through the indoctrination program, you essentially, as a member, you internalize the ideology, the beliefs, and the goals and wishes of the leader, and you take on total devotion to the leader. Once you have internalized all that, you, in a sense, become like a little microcosm of the cult. And when you're at that point, no one really needs to tell you what to do. You know exactly what to do and how you're supposed to behave. And so at that point, you're living in what I call a bounded reality. At that point, life outside of the cult seems impossible to you. You cannot imagine life outside the cult. So that when you are faced with decisions, and everybody has, you know, decisions to make while they're in a group, and nobody's actually holding a gun to your head. But when you're faced with decisions, you know exactly the decision you need to make in order to stay in the good graces of the group and stay on the path to whatever salvation you're being offered, so that your choices are bounded in the sense that your choices are constrained and limited by the will of the group and the will of the leader. So in a sense, your free will is altered.
And of course, that's why it's so tremendously hard to leave a cult, and we'll talk about that a little later. But let me ask you this. When Keith Raniere set up Nexium, do you think he envisaged it turning into a cult? Or do you think he slowly accrued sufficient power to want more power, and thus it ended up as a cult?
Well, you know, he certainly was a con artist, and he had had other scams before that had actually been, you know, shut down by regulations. They were these multi-marketing schemes. My sense is that, first of all, I don't think Keith would have succeeded in what he was doing at all if it weren't for the help of Nancy Salzman, who was his sort of second in command for many years. She really had the skills and the psychology behind how to manipulate people. And of course, what happens with cult leaders, because cults are not democratic, right? And there are no checks and balances. There's no way to challenge or criticize the leader. The more and more they get away with, the more extreme they'll become, the more they'll try to do because they see that they can do it. And so, you know, in some cases, they become absolutely delusional that they are supposedly this grand power or whatever. So I don't know that he sat down and said, oh, I'm going to start a cult, but he certainly had the impulse to control people and manipulate people. And he had, you know, his unbridled pedophilia and sexual perversion that had a lot to do with the shape that that group took.
One of the Nexium hierarchy now in prison, I think, is the Seagram liquor heiress, Claire Bronfman.
Yes.
Who continues to say, that Nexium changed her life for the better. She seems to be still in denial about the damage that it caused. Is that normal?
Well, you know, certainly when a cult is broken up by either, you know, some internal schism or in this case, you know, busted by the authorities, sometimes it's when the leader dies. There will be people who aren't able to break free. I mean, the ideas and the leaders still have such a hold on them. I mean, there are people still waiting for David Koresh to come back. You know, there are still people who follow Warren Jeffs, who is the imprisoned leader of the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints, the polygamous cult. So in her case, I think that she was so manipulated by him and so in love with him that she can't seem on her own, at least, to break away, break her thoughts from it. And, you know, I don't know if she's had any kind of counseling or intervention, but she's clearly holding firm.
It seems odd to me that I understand that a charismatic leader can persuade people to do all sorts of things, but Keith Raniere was not that charismatic, surely.
Well, no, when I sat in on the trial and the first day when he walked in, I looked at him and I thought, oh my God, you know, that little dweeb, you know, he's the one who got away with all of this. But what's important to understand about charisma is, you know, charisma is actually a social relationship. It's not some inherent attribute in someone, which is, I think, what most people think. And that's why we say charisma is in the eye of the beholder. It's all about how you respond to that person. And so for you, you may look at some guru and think, oh my God, he's the be all and end all. And your best friend might say, what, that goofy looking guy? So it's that social relationship. It's how you respond. And it's the follower actually who gives that attribute to the leader, gives the charisma to the leader. And that right in itself sets up this power imbalance where the one who you have deemed charismatic has power over you. And so it's really not about looks. It's about some kind of emotional tug, something that makes you respond to that person.
One thinks the same of Hitler, of course. I mean, we look at Hitler and think, how could people possibly have followed this guy? He's
exactly,
you know, plain and awkward and ridiculous, but nevertheless.
Right. It's a perfect example.
The idea of a cult. When it's taken to an extreme such as Nexium, one can understand it. But is it a continuum? Obviously, we can think of religious groups that some people might regard as a cult, other people regard as a legitimate belief system. Is there, in your mind, a clear difference?
Well, I think that you've raised two things there. One is that, yes, cults exist on a continuum from extremely harmful to maybe somewhat benign. In my opinion, I don't think if something is truly a cult, I even if it's a, quote, nice cult, I can't think of it as benign, because part of being a cult is that you give yourself up to that group. And I personally don't think it's ever good to lose your sense of autonomy, to lose your sense of self-control or decision-making. So that's one issue. The other issue is the difference between a cult and a religion. And I see a clear difference in that a healthy religion has you worshiping some type of higher being, right? Whether that's, you know, God, Jesus, Allah, Buddha, a tree, I don't care, whatever it is, but you're worshiping this higher being. You're not expected to worship this human being standing in front of you leading the services or whatever, right? So that's one big difference for me between a cult and a religion. Secondly, a religion can be quite strict and still not be a cult. So, for example, the Catholic Church is going to tell you don't use birth control, right? But they're not coming into your bedroom and checking if you're using birth control, whereas a cult might do that, right? Or they may say, you know, they may give you guidelines for living, you know, be nice to your neighbor, you know, whatever, help them shovel the snow in the winter. But again, no one's checking up on you that you're doing that. They're general guidelines for you to hopefully absorb and live by, but there's no punishment if you don't. And so that to me is another important difference.
Is Scientology a cult?
I don't ever talk about Scientology. I'm sorry.
Because why?
Because they have such a history of harassing people. And I worked for a long time with Dr. Margaret Singer, who was the sort of preeminent cult expert for many years. She's passed away now, but they made her life such hell. And I've seen what they've done to other people. And I made a decision years ago that I was not going to publicly talk about Scientology so that I could do what I do in peace. And I feel that it's better if it's former Scientologists who are talking about Scientology.
All right. Thank you for that. It's a diplomatic and yet revealing answer. As we've said, it is hard to leave a cult because of the very nature of a cult. You have worked with people who have left, are in recovery, as it were. How have they left, and how do you help them stay out?
Well, people leave in all kinds of ways. You know, some just walk out the door and leave. Some leave because of perhaps some kind of crisis. Like I worked with a woman once who developed a very serious kind of cancer, and she realized that, you know, she woke up one day and said to herself, I don't want to die while I'm in this group. And that got her to leave. So sometimes it's a personal crisis. Some people leave because of an intervention. You know, I suppose there's a certain number who leave in that way. Mostly people leave because there's one more thing that happens that sort of, you know, the straw that breaks the camel's back that gets them to realize they're in something that's not right and they should get out. And then when people get out, they're going to be in various degrees of trauma and need for help. I mean, it depends on the age the person got in. It depends on what kind of resources they may be able to find when they get out, if they still have family they can go to, things like that. So the recovery process is very different for everyone. What I do, and the reason I've written my books, is I have the one book, Take Back Your Life, which is kind of a general recovery book. And then I have the other book, Escaping Utopia, which is about children who grew up in cults, because the children who come out, usually as, you know, older adolescents or adults, have somewhat different issues from someone who joined a cult as an adult. So in my books, and if I'm working with someone, I have various exercises I give them to do. It's very important. I think the first thing is really important for the person to unpack, like really get a sense of what was the power of the system that they were in. Because until they can see the enormity of what they had been entrapped in, so to speak, they're often living with a lot of shame and guilt, right? There's like, why didn't I leave sooner? How could I have let that happen? How could I have participated in that? You know, all of these things that will be troubling them. But once they see the enormity of the system and the processes that were at work on them, it gives them some relief that they're able to deal with, you know, in a good way, you know, process the guilt and the shame and the fear and all the other emotions that got manipulated by the group. So that's one thing. And then another really important part of recovery, I think, is finding a support group of other survivors. Like right now, I have a support group that I co-facilitate with a therapist every other Saturday. And we have men and women from all over the United States, from other countries. We've had people actually from New Zealand coming to our group. You know, it's done by Zoom now. And these support groups are so helpful because people are able to see that they're not the only one. There's comfort in that. They hear other people talk about the group they were in, and they realize the similarity to their own group, even though the words might be different or what they called a particular thing. And they also can really help each other with, like, what worked for me? Maybe this will work for you. You know, these are my triggers. Here's how I handle my triggers. And so it's a very much a back and forth process. And really, those sessions are, they're so meaningful. And I mean, every week when I finish it, I'm just in awe of people and how much they're able to help each other.
I'm talking to Dr. Janja Lalić about cults. How often do people return to the cult because they find the outside world too hard?
I would say not very often. I mean, a lot of that is going to depend on whether they do the kind of, you know, self-examination or do this kind of what we call psychoeducation when they get out so that they do understand what they were involved in and how they got involved. If they don't process it, it's possible they may go back to their group or join another group, which we call cult hopping, because they haven't yet figured out why they're getting drawn into these groups. But most people don't go back. And actually in my book, Escaping Utopia, that I just mentioned, I interviewed 68 individuals who grew up in 39 different cults. And I asked them, did you ever think of going back? And not a single one, once they got out, they never, ever thought of going back. And these are people who, for the most part, had family still in the group, you know, parents, other relatives. And even with that, they never thought of going back.
Despite the dreadful evidence that came out at the Ranieri trial, some people, as we said, still support him, say it was consensual. Now, these people are apparently smart, high achievers in law, medicine, business, movies. How is it that they can be duped? What is the mechanism by which somebody seems to suspend their judgment in this way?
Well, you know, this is one of the, you know, I'm glad you raised this because this is one of the myths about cults, you know, that it's stupid, weird, crazy people who get into cults, when the reality is who cults want to recruit are A-type personalities. They want to recruit people who can, you know, perform for the cult, run their businesses, bring in their friends, bring in money, lend legitimacy to the group in some way. And so cults don't want, you know, lazy people or sick people. And so, you know, the way it happens, I think, is that, you know, a person may get invited to something or may see an ad for something or get told about something and go check out the first thing. It has to be a message that resonates with you. It has to be something that at that moment in your life seems like something that would bring some good to you. you know, I always say for myself, because I was in a cult myself in the 70s and 80s, and it was a political cult. And I always say I could never have joined a meditation cult because I can't sit still that long. But a political cult, you know, a group that said we were about changing the world, we were going to fight racism and sexism and classism and all. Well, that sounded terrific to me, right? So the message draws you in. The message has to resonate with you. You don't know what you're getting into in the beginning. You don't know what the bottom line is. Once you start taking classes or courses or whatever it might be with that particular group, you're going to get drawn in more and more and more. You get indoctrinated through their system, whatever it might be, until you have fully grasped, as I was saying earlier, internalized what it's all about, and it has meaning for you. You believe it has meaning for you, and you still may not think there's anything terrible happening. And if terrible things are happening, the cult has probably justified it in a way that it's not supposed to be seem terrible anymore, right? You've basically, your whole sense of morality changes, so that we see these people who are still supporters of Keith Raniere, who obviously are intelligent people, and they can't give up the dream. They have totally bought into the idea that, you know, he's being falsely accused, that none of this really happened, that yes, those women did it consensually, even though they had collateral on them. And they hold on to that because for some people, it's just simply too difficult to face the fact that they've been duped.
That expression, collateral, that means that they were blackmailed, does it?
Yes, absolutely. Right. That's why it's ridiculous to say that it was consensual.
I want to talk, obviously, about your experience in the Democratic Workers' Party, as you described a little earlier, as a cult. But I just want to ask you about the idea of investment. You know, people have spent years and they've bought into it. It begins, surely, with the idea of a very expensive course, therefore very important. You mentioned the courses were very expensive, Keith mm-hmm. Raniere's. That must be the start of it. If you put so much money into something, you've got to make it worth it.
Well, that's certainly part of it, yes. And especially for those kinds of groups that demand that kind of, you know, financial output. And also for many people, it's the investment of time. And also that over time, you no longer perhaps have any friends outside, you know, who aren't part of the group. And so you're sort of cut off from the people who once were important to you. And so it just becomes harder and harder and harder because you're just swallowed up in this world. And it's an altered reality. And you don't think about those other things anymore. And that's why I say to people who have someone in a group, you know, remind them of times that you had together that were good times, you know, send them postcards, send them family photos, you know, tug at their emotional heartstrings because that's been all pushed back because of the cult training.
Remind them that there is another world. So you gave yourself up to the Democratic Workers' Party in the 70s and 80s, as I understand it, a radical Marxist-Leninist group. What made it a cult? What was your experience?
Well, again, when I joined, I didn't know it was a cult. And, you know, like many people, I didn't really even know what I was joining. But we had a leader who was a woman. She had, you know, oddly enough, been a sociology professor, an unsuccessful one. And she was very domineering. And she was older than most of the rest of us. And so, you know, she had this PhD. And, you know, so, of course, we thought she was, you know, brilliant. And but she also was, like most narcissists, very erratic in her behavior. You never knew, you know, if it was going to be the nice Marlene who showed up or the absolutely monster Marlene who showed up. So you were constantly on pins and needles, you know, whenever you knew she was going to appear. So everything was about her and advancing her desires and wishes. You know, we would start all kinds of programs. And then one day she'd say, oh, just get rid of that program. And we'd say, well, but there's like 1,000 people supporting us. And she's like, it doesn't matter. You know, she'd make up some reason that we were supposed to buy into. So it was all about her. Our time was completely controlled. We had absolutely not a minute, nor were we given permission to see people outside of the group unless we were trying to recruit them. We were all encouraged to live in houses with other members, so we were pretty much surrounded by each other all the time. The finances were, people turned over everything that they had if they got inheritances or tax returns or whatever, and everybody lived on a piddly little amount of money. And we worked, you know, 20-hour days, 7 days a week, week after week, month after month, year after year. We were exhausted, and we spent an enormous amount of time in what were called struggle sessions, where someone would be criticized, and we basically just tore each other apart, and people lost any kind of self-esteem or self-confidence or sense of self, and it was all about serving our leader.
How did you extract yourself?
Well, that's a really long story. So basically what happened is that we finally had our revolution in that the leader was out of the country at one point. And so the leadership, we called together all of the members and told them what was going on. I had been in leadership and in the inner circle. And so we started telling people, you know, she's an alcoholic and this and that. And it took about a week to actually convince people that we were telling the truth. And the night before she came back, we took a vote and unanimously voted to expel her and dissolve the organization. So we all got out at the same time.
So you had quite a degree of power, which is not, I mean, you know, you've looked at cults like the Heaven's Gate cult or the Bo Peep group, which collectively suicided in 1997, that those people had obviously no power whatsoever left.
Well, yeah, that's debatable. But I mean, I think, interestingly, Heaven's Gate, you know, had the two leaders, T and Doe, and earlier they were called Bo and Peep. But anyway, after T was actually the real leader of that group. And after T died, Doe had a difficult time accepting that he would be able to be the leader. And it was, in a sense, it was the members who convinced him that he could do it. And so there were some members in that group who did have a lot of influence and a certain amount of influence over Doe and the decisions that they made as a group. But ultimately, yeah, they all gave up their power in the end. That's not how they saw it, but yeah.
There are a number of people who say that Donald Trump has founded a cult already or is in the process of founding a cult because of the lies and the self-delusion, the conspiracy theories, the demand for loyalty and the chanting and so on at the rallies. Mm-hmm. What's your view?
Oh, absolutely. I believe we are witnessing, I mean, it's a little more ephemeral right now, but certainly while he was still president, we were really witnessing a kind of a cult on a national scale. And it wasn't allowed to develop to its fullest extent because he was voted out. But I don't believe we've seen the end of it. And Trump certainly behaved like a cult leader. I don't know that word ever entered his mind, but he clearly wanted to be a sort of dictator. He loved all those other dictators, and his followers are behaving with the same kind of sort of blind followership and absolute loyalty. I think it's a bit more complicated because I also think some of the groups, you know, if we look at what happened on January 6th, I mean, some of the groups that have sort of entered into that world, I think in a sense they were using Trump to push forward their ideas of white supremacy and white nationalism, even though he, of course, encouraged them and is himself a racist. But so now we have this kind of mishmash of people with slightly different ideas and beliefs, yet Trump seems to be the common denominator that pulls them together.
What can be done?
Oh, gosh. I wish I had the answer to that. Well, I think there's several things that need to be done. One is, I think, as much as possible, people who have friends or family members involved in QAnon or some of these conspiracy ideas should try to do whatever they can to ease those people away from those ideas.
That's easier said than done, right? You know that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. But I think people shouldn't give up. You know, I've seen people leave cults after 40, 50 years. So, you know, I do believe you should never give up. And even though some of their beliefs are completely deplorable, despicable, you don't want to really challenge the beliefs. You want to, as I was saying earlier, you want to tug at their emotional heartstrings and see if you can get into gentle conversations with them. So one thing is not giving up on those people. I mean, unless they're the really super violent hardcore. Well, that's a different issue. Secondly, I think the government needs to really put a lot of effort back into fighting domestic terrorism, which, you know, all of that money was taken away when Trump came in. So they need to reinforce all of our intelligence agencies and, other law enforcement agencies that can uproot these groups and try to disband them. You know, right now, these groups that have always been fringe, now they seem like, you know, this really cool mass movement, right? So what we need to do, I think, is make them fringe again, make them seem like nobodies, you know, arrest them, imprison them, get rid of their leaders, you know, whatever, bust them up in whatever way we can. And then I think another thing that somehow has to happen on a national scale is to really better educate the public about, you know, the risks and dangers of this kind of thinking in these kinds of groups, so that we need to, you know, teach about critical thinking again. I mean, we've really witnessed and I'm sure this is no surprise to you, you know, we've witnessed the dumbing, what I call the dumbing down of America. You know, I mean, we have people who don't even read a book, you know, and they listen to, you know, talk radio and late night UFO radio channels and things like that. So the more we can have some kind of really broad-based, community-based educational programs. And of course, I know everybody, you know, there are certain people who are going to scream socialism when they hear me talking about national education programs. But we need to, you know, kind of get back to common sense. And I'm also hoping that with Biden as president now, and with hopefully some really good positive changes, you know, some of which we're already seeing, hopefully people won't feel as desperate as many Americans have felt, which I think has led them to grab onto these crazy frameworks. And I'm hoping that'll ease up some.
But when you talk about arrest, imprisonment, and national education programs, I feel that Trump supporters will merely be emboldened by being victimized, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I mean, that is a risk, but we can't let them, I mean, we can't let them carry on in the way they have. I mean, we can't abide by these armed militias, you know, storming capitals and threatening to assassinate governors or Nancy Pelosi or whoever. I mean, I think as a nation, we have to take a stand against that kind of behavior. And, you know, everyone always says, well, this isn't America. Well, this is what America has become. And I think we need to pull back and really get our bearings again as a democratic society.
I take the point you made earlier that it's not only that Trump has indoctrinated people, but that people have seized on Trump to enable their views to be heard. But you have said that you think people in cults and involved in criminal activity should be given lighter sentences than others, because of the issue of free will. Does that not complicate the issue of clamping down on people who support Trump?
Well, I think that has to be done within reason. I think it's one thing if someone has been completely influenced by a cult to, you know, go out and rob a bank or kill
or
someone.
Or storm the Capitol.
Well, or storm the Capitol. So I think there's a difference, though, between someone who, as a follower of Trump, ended up being in that mob, but wasn't armed, wasn't involved in, you know, some of the more brutal behavior that went on. I think the leaders of that whole thing, the people who planned it, the people who funded it, they need to be held responsible without, you know, without any kind of mitigation. So I think there's a difference.
So I suppose the problem now is that social media has enabled movements to be a great deal more amorphous than in the past. And so it's very difficult to find the leader.
In many cases, yes. I mean, it's what we're seeing now is so different from, you know, what I sometimes call now the run-of-the-mill cults, right? Where it was very clear, you know, here's the compound, here's the leader, you know, here's all of the followers dressed in orange. And it's not so easy anymore with so many of these internet-based cults.
What's the, we mentioned Heaven's Gate, maybe that was it, the most powerful cult, the most damaging cult that you've had any dealings with?
Yeah, I mean, I was around when Jonestown happened, but I was actually in my cult when that happened. You know, and I think Jonestown was a very different situation. For one, so many more people died, and not at all willingly. I mean, in terms of deaths, yes, Heaven's Gate is the biggest one. But, you know, I've dealt with cults that have been absolutely cruel to their members, and especially in terms of sexual abuse of children, that in some ways it is even more harmful, more hurtful.
It sounds as if your work with people who have left cults gives you sufficient optimism to carry on, because otherwise it would be a terribly depressing specialty.
It is, believe me, and it's a very isolated specialty. I was just talking to my therapist friend who I do the support group with, and I was just saying, you know, how, you know, it's really quite a lonely field. I mean, there really are just a handful of us who do this, and every day, I swear to you, every day I learn about new cults. Every time I think I've heard everything, I hear another horror story. And so, I have to find ways to keep myself, you know, self-care, as they say. You know, I've got my lovely dog who's, you know, goes on nice long walks with me, and I have, you know, friends and that I can do things with. And, you know, it is a tough field because there's so much horror. And I guess the only positive is that the help I've been able to provide in people's recovery and in, you know, doing this kind of education of the public. And hopefully fewer people will end up joining a group because of maybe something I said one day.
Are you suggesting that there are more and more cults at the moment?
Yes, absolutely. And it started to really grow in the 70s and 80s, I believe, with the growth of the New Age movement and people's interest in crystals and UFOs and speaking to dead people and ascended beings and channeling and all of that. And then we had a real growth of fundamentalist churches in our country, at least, that became very cultic because they were non-denominational, so they were not part of any larger structure where they could be held accountable. And then we have seen also many, many groups have entered into the mainstream and especially into the corporate world, so that so many businesses send their employees to these leadership workshops or management workshops, many of which are channels into a cultic organization that's the head of it. We've also seen the growth of multi-level marketing companies, some of which have become very cultic. And then with the internet, you know, we've seen a whole new wave of things that have drawn people in. So yes, there are absolutely more cults than ever before.
I mean, you've said one doesn't join a cult. You join a group of like-minded people. I mean, it sounds like one has to check every book group.
Well, you know, it's true. I mean, if there's any common denominator among who joins cults, it's idealism. And so people want to be around people who think like them or find some meaning and purpose in their life. You know, we're social animals. And so there are so many good, absolutely good and wonderful organizations and groups that we can belong to. But then, you know, there are always going to be people who take advantage of that. And so I think it is important to be a good consumer. And before you sign your life away, you know, to really check out what you're doing. Don't be rushed. You know, do what you do when you buy a car. You don't buy the first car you drive, right? You look around, you drive several, you ask people who own different models. And if people did that same thing when they're checking out some kind of, you know, spiritual practice or self-improvement course or whatever, I think that would help people stay out of the ones that are more questionable. One thing to look out for that I like to warn people is about waivers. You know, if you're being asked to sign a waiver that if something happens to you, you're not going to hold that group or organization responsible. Well, that right there should be a red flag. Why are they asking you to sign that unless there's a possibility that something might happen? So all of those kinds of things, you know, I'm hoping people will learn to pay more attention to.
That was Dr. Janja Lalić, Professor Emerita of Sociology at California State University.